Okay, so it's not clear yet in general this year whether I will be doing a series in Tila again. The last 2 years we have because it was an interest. We'll see. But at least for today, we're going to do a little bit on Tfilah of the Yamim Noraim. Obviously the way the calendar falls out this year, by the time you get out of Bidud, it's only going to be a few days from Rosh Hashanah. So I wanted to share a very central idea from Rabbi Yosef Albo about the tefillah of Rosh Hashanah. So before I share the screen, the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah is unique, right? From all the Amidot of the entire year, what does it have that nothing else has, right? What does the Amidah of Rosh Hashanah have that nothing else has in the entire year? What's unique about it? So it doesn't have vidui. Yom Kippur has vidui, right? All right, but you're right. Yom Kippur has vidui, but Rosh Hashanah, right? What is totally and completely unique about the Amidah of Rosh Hashanah of Musaf? There's too many of you on, so you just have to call out. You just have to sort of. And then tell me who's talking, because I can't necessarily. What's unique about it? Yeah. Okay, so good. Shofar blowing is integrated at least in Chazaret HaShatz and Minhag Ashkenaz, and into both parts of it. Okay, well, let me ask you a question. How long, in general, is the Amidah? How many brachot are in the Amidah during most of the year? During the week, how many? 19, good. And then Shabbos? There's seven, right? The three beginning, three end, and only one in the middle. Very good. Right? Rosh Hashanah davening is the only time. Rosh Hashanah Musaf is the only Amidah of the year which has nine brachot. Right? The same beginning three, the same ending three, but unlike the middle of the week where you have the bakashot, the 13 brachot of requests that you have in the middle, and unlike a normal Shabbat, a normal Yom Tov, including the rest of Rosh Hashanah itself, right? There isn't one central bracha which focuses on Kedushat Hayom, on the sanctity of the day. There are three brachot, right? There are three brachot, and what are they? The Gemara already outlines what are the three brachot in the middle of Rosh Hashanah davening, in the middle of Musaf. Good. As Ezra says correctly, Malchiyot Zichronot and Shofarot, right? We have the first bracha, which has two concepts, two themes. It accomplishes the first half of what every Yom Tov has. A discussion of Kedushat Hayom, right? Mikadesh Yisrael vit, whatever, right? Mikadesh Yisrael, in this case, Yom HaZikaron. But you have that always, right? You have that on Pesach, you have that, right? Mikadesh Yisrael v'hazmanim, right? You have it on Shabbat, just Mikadesh Shabbat, without the Yisrael, because as the Gemara in Beit Zadav Yud Zayin notes, that Shabbat, the sanctity is not dependent on Bnei Yisrael. God sanctified it directly, as opposed to the Chagim, where God gives over the power of the calendar to Beit Din, and therefore it's Mekadesh Yisrael v'hazmanim. God sanctified the Jews, and then the Jews in turn sanctify the holidays. So the first half of Malchiyot deals with that, and then, or part of it deals with that. And then you have Malchiyot, which deals with, right, what's Malchiyot? Kings, what does kings mean? Yeah, we're crowning Hashem, right? We're coronating God as monarch, as king, as melech of the world. Good. Okay, what is Zichronot about? Someone else, what's Zichronot about? Or Zichronos, if you only heard it in Ashkenazis. Okay, I don't care. You can speak however you want. right? But if that jogs your memory, then matov. Yeah, what's Zacharnos about? Wow. Okay, you guys are what, 18? And fine. Right. Zichronot is about gods. Ouch. Ouch. Okay, yes. Thank you for that pun. You're right. It is ironic that no one remembers what remembrance is about. Yes, Zichronot is about God. Okay. Okay, good. It is remembrance, but remembrance for what? It's remembrance for our misdeeds, our mitzvot, averot, and meaning God doesn't forget, and therefore there are consequences, good and bad, for what we do, right? Both on an individual level, on a national level, right? And there's Zichron Zichronot talks about the fact that God remembers what we did. He remembers what he did with Noah. He remembers with, right? Remembers the consequences that come. He remembers what we did, and therefore there are consequences from that. Okay, good. And shofarot, what does shofarot deal with? And don't just tell me the shofar. It's true, the shofar, but yeah, okay, what's in shofarot? What do we talk about in shofarot besides for the shofar? We don't just say, oh, there is this beautiful ram's horn and it is nice and curvy and shiny, and right, we don't do that. So we talk about any all events and situations in which the shofar was used, usually in cases where God is manifest in some way. From, yes, we talk about the shofar on the Chatzotzrot in the Beit HaMikdash. We talk about the shofar blast that was heard at Matan Torah in Revelation at Har Sinai. We talk about the shofar of Mashiach, right? We talk about the shofar blast and the events of God's presence that it heralds, right? Right, that's Malchiyot, Zichronot, and Shofarot. Okay, what I want to do today is focus on an analysis by Rabbi Yosef Albo. Now, who is Rabbi Yosef Albo? So, Rabbi Yosef Albo lives in the late 14th, early 15th century. He is one of the disputants at Tortosa. Any Jewish historians here? What is the dispute at Tortosa? Very good. Yes, it was very good. In 14, 13, 14, 14, in Tortosa, which is part of of Spain, people keep coming in, right? A Jewish Christian debate was called, as was often happened in the world, and Torah was attacked. The Talmud was attacked. And one of the disputants there is Rabbi Yosef Albo. Rabbi Yosef Albo is a student of some of the very important late Rishonic thinkers. He's a student of Ralbag. He's a student of Tashbeit. He's a student of Reb Chasdai Kreskes, right? And he writes a work of Jewish philosophy that is a bit more popular in the sense that it's written for more of a popular audience than, let's say, the Mor Nebuchadnezzar. It's easier to read. It's much clearer that way. It's how much it's meant as a popular work rather than as an esoteric work is not exactly clear. It was traditionally thought of as a popular work, but in the last few years, at least two dissertations have come out arguing that that is not the way of the proper way of understanding it, one in Israel, one in America. But whatever it is, he writes a book called Sefer HaIkarim. And in the first section of Sefer HaIkarim, he introduces his Ikarei Emunah. Okay, so the reason I want to talk about this is because it's a chance to talk about some relatively large concepts here in Jewish philosophy, in addition to the Amidah of Rosh Hashanah. So, how many of you have ever, in any way, studied any version of the Ikarei Emunah, the fundamentals of faith, shall we call them? I assume you know some of them, right? What is arguably the most famous, well-known of the Ikarei Emunah in Judaism? Who penned them? Who wrote them? The Rambam, very good. How many does he have? 13, very good. The Rambam has 13 Ikare Emuna. However, they are very odd. They are very odd. It's not odd that you're supposed to believe these things. That makes a lot of sense. What's odd about the Ikare Emuna, which is pointed out by many of the Rishonim, and Rabbi Yosef Albo is probably the most extensive of it, also Rabbi Chasdei Kreskes, is that it's not entirely clear why the Rambam picked these. Because for the Rambam, right, so some of them make sense. You should believe in God. Okay, that's one of them. But the Rambam also has one Ikar about the existence of prophecy and another Ikar about the uniqueness of Moshe's prophecy, about Moshe's Nevuah. Okay? Now, that's a little bit odd. Why would you divide those, right? Now, you might say that why is it important for the Rambam to mention the Moshe's Nevuah being unique as a separate Ikar from Nevuah in general? Why is that important? Why would you think that's important? Why is it important to separate that as a separate Ikar Emunah? Well, why are those two separate, right, two separate statements for the Rambam? Why does he divide them? You might tell me there's a good reason. Why are they separate? Good, but why? Why is it so important to highlight Moshe's Nevuah? What, right? It's not just there were other prophets. Why is it so important to highlight Moshe's Nevuah? He's the greatest of Nevi'im, and therefore, right? So part of that for the Rambam is, why is that important? It's not just important to know that. Why is that central to our faith? Because Moshe's Nevuah is unique, what does that mean about the content of his Nevuah? Exactly. Or in other words, it makes it that the Torah can never be replaced. Because if Moshe's Nevuah is sui generis, I told the guys in my share I would do that sometimes. I'm sorry. That was Latin. Sui generis. Right? One of a kind. Unique. Okay? The fact that his Nevuah is unique is part of what makes it, right? And it's undiluted and it's pure and direct and whatever. It makes it that the content is Nevuah, i.e. what we know as the Torah, can never be replaced, right? Because it is there's something unique about the content of what he says. Now, so you might say that the reason that you have to specify the separate Ikar that Moshe's Nevuah is the best and most direct is because it implies something about the Torah, that it can never be replaced. What's the problem? The Rambam counts the fact that the Torah can never be replaced as a separate, as its own Ikar, right? So why exactly do you need all three of those, right? I understand why you might need two of those, that there is prophecy and the Torah will never be replaced, right? But presumably the uniqueness of Moshe's Nevuah could have been integrated into the general belief in prophecy, or if the reason that Moshe's Nevuah being unique is important is because it contributes uniquely to the Torah, so then it should be integrated into the belief in the fact that the Torah can never be changed. And different questions like this have led the Rishonim to try to figure out what it is that the Rambam meant by Ikar Emunah. But fundamentally, what does the Rambam mean by Ikar? Right? The Rambam means by Ikar what we would say in English, dogma, meaning an Ikar for the Rambam is a belief without which you are a heretic. Okay? It is the list of things that you must believe. Now, why did he pick these? So here there's a divide. There is the Lumdish approach, which is quoted from Reb Chaim Brisker, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. This is going to get confusing in just a second. But, which is that the Rambam picked these because they have a different halachic status. The way it was quoted to me when I was in ninth grade, so for the Rambam guys, the first mishmar of my ninth grade in Rambam in 2002, Rabbi Ziskind gave shir on this from this Reb Chaim and taught us, for most of us, our first Yiddish, right? Which was, right, that the point is that nebuch an apikares is ois an apikares. Even if, in this case, in everything else in the Torah, if someone grew up not from, didn't know he was Jewish, so you don't fault him, you don't call him a heretic for not believing in different things about the Torah. But these 13 things, the Rambam is telling you that even if you're nebuch an apikares, right, it's too bad, you didn't grow up, you didn't know that this was heretical, but doesn't matter, you're still an apikares, you're still a heretic, because they have a unique status. They have a unique status of things you have to believe. That's Reb Chaim's approach. Others, however, argue, such as Reb Chaim's great-grandson, the Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik's son, confusing, but also Chaim Soloveitchik, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, argues that that's not how you should understand the Rambam at all. The Rambam isn't telling you that these beliefs are unique fundamentally. The Rambam was basically giving an educational list for his generation. And he was taking the beliefs that were under attack, and he was telling you that you have to believe them. And with that, he explains, why does the Rambam say that the uniqueness of Moshe's Nevuah is one Ikar, and the fact that the Torah can never be replaced is another Ikar? Because each of those was attacked by a major religion, right? Islam thinks that Moshe was a prophet, but not the greatest prophet, Muhammad was. And Christianity thinks the Torah can be replaced. And therefore, the Rambam wrote a separate Ikar, one to tell you that you don't believe in Islam, and the other to tell you that you don't believe in Christianity, okay? So it's fundamentally an educational document more than it is a fundamental one, okay? Now, there, yeah, but that's also true, but it's not central, right? To them, it's more about him being God or something, like, at least in Catholicism. But also more fundamental for them is the fact that the import of that is that you can replace the Torah, right? That's, right, that the Torah can be superseded, right? Supersessionist theology. But yes, they also believe that. So in that sense, it also does counter certain beliefs of Christianity. Yeah. Okay. But several other Rishonim said that systematically, this is just the wrong way to think about Ikarei Emunah. And chief among them was Rabbi Yosef Albo. So Rabbi Yosef Albo, and I'll pull it up on the screen, Rabbi Yosef Albo raises all these problems in the Rambam, and he says to him, listen, and I'll tell you before the way I once heard it from Rabbi Shalom Carmi, and I think it's very helpful. While the Rambam thinks Ikarei Emunah are dogma, right, meaning things that you have to believe, the Rabbi Yosef Albo in Sefer Ikarim thinks that an Ikar is a fundamental, meaning a foundation, right? For him, the only things that get to be called an Ikar, again, he doesn't necessarily agree that, he doesn't disagree that you have to believe everything the Rambam said. He does believe that. But organizationally, he comes up with a different taxonomy, a different way of classifying it. And he says Ikar is foundation, meaning those things without which Judaism would be incoherent or religion would be incoherent, right? It's not just a laundry list of things you have to believe. It's those things that without which religion or Judaism doesn't make sense, right? It's just not a logical system. Right, so what does he include? So now if you look at what I pulled up on the screen, he says, "Haderach hanachon shiyareh li b'sfirat ha'ikarim, shem sharashim v'yisodot l'torah ha'elohit hu." The ikarim, meaning the roots of religion. "Ki ha'ikarim ha'kolilim v'hechrecheim l'dar ha'elohit hem shlosha." There are three things that are necessary, hechreyach, for religion. And they are the following. "Hem mitzi'ut Hashem," the belief in God, hashkachal ischar v'onesh, the fact that God, there's divine providence, which leads to consequences, reward and punishment, v'torah min hashamayim, and the Torah is given from heaven, meaning, essentially three things. There is a God, he has a message for humanity, and there are consequences if you don't listen to what God said, right? If you boil down religion, those are the three fundamentals of religion. There is a God, he has a message for humanity, and there are consequences if you to what you do. Everything else, he argues, is a subset of that. And he says, "Ve'ilu ashloshahim avot lekol ikarim." These are the fathers of all fundamentals. Asher ledatot ha'eliyot. Really, for all religion. Forget Judaism. It's true of all religion. Kemo Torat Adam, Torat Noach, Torat Abraham, Torat Moshe. V'zulat zemen ha'torot ha'eliyot im efshar shimatzei yoter me'achad bizman echad o bezo achar zo. He notes, "V'tachad kol ikar me'ilu sharashim u'si'ifin." Mr. Gim, Mr. Afim, and Ikaro, there are branches to these beliefs. Kitachara Mitsiur Hashem, within the belief that there is a God, who Shoreshayoto Kadmon and Tzchivito Mehen, is the fact that God is eternal and that God is primordial. Uvichlal Torah Mineshamayim, and as a subset of the fact that there's Torah, is Yidiyar Hashem, Vanevua, is prophecy and God's foreknowledge. Uvichlal Ashkacha, and under the branch of divine providence, right, is in this world and the next world, so therefore the Rambam Zikarim, Mashiach, Olam Haba, all that is underneath the rubric of Scharvonish, right? So unlike the Rambam, who categorizes the Ikarim as dogma, as things that you have to believe, Rabbi Yosef Alvo asked a different question. And he says, an Ikar is... are those things you need to make religion coherent, right? And that is, one, there is a God, and everything included in that, that God is eternal and God is primordial. Two, is that there, God has instructions for the world. So there is a Torah who's given at Sinai, there are Nevi'im, there are prophets that communicate, etc. And three, is that there are consequences. So that means punishment in this world, punishment in the next world, Mashiach, Olam Haba. But fundamentally, all of belief can be boiled down to three fundamental principles. Meaning, if there is no God, right? And he has, right? Meaning religion, right? Basically assumes, all religions assume, with the possible exception of Buddhism, that there is a divine being, right, with expectations of humanity, and what you do and whether you listen to that divine being matters, right? That is like the ABCs of all religion, right? If there is nothing that you're supposed to do, right, there are no expectations, then you don't have religion. You might have spirituality, you don't have religion, right? Religion carries with it a certain set of expectations. If there are no consequences to what you do, so then it's very nice to say that you should do this and you shouldn't do that, but if there are no consequences, so then what gives religion, right? What gives those expectations teeth, right? If there is no divine being behind the system, then why are you expected to do it, right? Meaning this is, it gives it coherence. Again, it doesn't make it, it's not about truth. It's about coherence. It's about, right? This is true of pagan religions also, right? A polytheistic pagan believes there are multiple gods. They want you to sacrifice to them. They want you to whatever. And if they, and if you don't, they will punish you, right? And that's what led pagans to sacrifice and to build temples to Zeus and to whatever, right? Because they believed in a divine being. They believed there were certain expectations, and they believed that if they didn't live up to the expectations, then the gods would not be happy and there would be consequences, right? Meaning all religions, right? Right, again, Buddhism might be an exception here, but I don't know, but he didn't really know about that, right? But basically all religions assume some sort of divine being, or in the case of polytheism, beings, certain expectations of mankind and consequences, right? That's like the basic structure of religion. So it provides a coherence. This is not about whether it's true or not true. It's not, right? It's what makes a religion have a logic to it. See, this is right. So this is a very modern, right? This is a very modern argument, right? Where consequences are not part of the picture at all, right? But, right, no traditional religion, right, or no religion really at all, right, believes that because it's true. It might be that regardless of consequences, look, Torah also believes that you should do the right thing regardless of consequences, right? That's a Mishnah, right, which you probably all know, right? That Antignus Yisocha Omer, right? Al Tiyuka Avadim Shamshin Arava Manat Lekabal Pras. Al Tiyuka Avadim Shamshin Arav Shalom Manat Lekabal Pras. Right? Don't be like a servant who only does what he does for the purpose of getting reward. Do it not for that reason, right? So for sure, right? You should do things simply because they are the right thing. However, right? No system that's made for a community in the history of the world has ever been successful without the belief in consequences, right? Now, that could be, right? That doesn't mean that's the only reason you do it, but that is necessary, right? Empirically, right? Has been necessary in every system in order to make the system run. Now, in some systems, that's, right? You could have a non-religious political system, right? But, right, a political system isn't going to work unless, right, it can enforce laws. Now, there have been political systems that don't enforce the laws, but those were usually theological systems where they believed that there is a God or gods who will ensure there are consequences, right? But en masse, again, we should be very clear. It's not, this doesn't mean to say that you shouldn't do the right thing simply because it's the right thing and avoid to do the wrong, doing the wrong thing because it's the wrong thing to do. Obviously, that's true. But the question of whether you can have a coherent system that actually expects to work, right, en masse, and not for an individual, but for a community, a country, a nation, a world, without the belief there would be consequences ever, right, it doesn't seem to be practical, right? Because you can kick and scream and yell as much as you want and say it's wrong, but if there are no consequences, right, then the people who don't care will do it anyways. Fine, but the belief in that system is exactly what led people, right? Meaning, you're right, no one can know, but the belief in that system is what kept people committed to religion, right? Meaning, this is descriptive, not prescriptive, right? This is true of religions that are idolatrous, right? But what kept Hindus who were at the bottom of society in the untouchable caste, right? What kept many of them from running away and living a different life somewhere else was the fact that they also believed that metaphysically there would be consequences if they didn't live within that, right? Within that world, right? Within that lifestyle, within that rubric, right? Meaning, if someone denies it, you're right, that takes the bite away. But the whole point is that religious systems work because there is, right? That's exactly the point, because there is a belief. You're saying there isn't a belief, and this is why Ryosev Albo is saying that belief in such, right, belief in this is necessary for the system to work, right? Your point proves his point, right? Meaning, if no one believed it, then the system wouldn't work, right? That's what he's saying. He's saying it's an ikar in the sense that it is necessary, because you're right. Nobody knows, and therefore said, I don't know, and therefore I don't believe it, so I don't care, right? Then they wouldn't keep the system. The system would collapse. That's his point. Right? That's exactly his point. I didn't say it was ideal, right? I said that it's realistic because not everybody, right? The Torah isn't written only for individuals, it's written for societies. And there are always going to be many people in society who need this. the expectation that every single person in society will be ideal and will do everything regardless of consequence, right, is not a way of building a society. It works for maybe individuals. It does not work for a society, right? And religions are, right, religions are based around community, are based around, right, not just individuals. They're based around people en masse. And that's exactly the point, right? Meaning, again, I'm not saying that a single person cannot do the right thing because it's the right thing. That obviously is the ideal. But what he's arguing is that a religion cannot realistically expect to function as a religion for a community of people if there is no belief in consequences, right? That's what he's saying, right? And I think descriptively that's... What? What do you mean the end justifies it means? He also believes it's true, right? He's not saying we're lying and we're saying there are punishments just so that you keep it. He's saying, right, this actually is true, and people believing that is true is what allows this, right, this society for average people to continue, right? I don't know what it means the ends justify the means, like, you know. But I don't understand. He's saying this is what he's saying, that in order to make religion coherent, meaning that the average person will keep religion, right, there have to be consequences and people have to believe that, because otherwise many people just won't care, right? It's not the ends justify the means. It's a description of the reality, that without the reality and the belief in that reality of consequences, the average person won't keep religion and therefore religion won't exist as a religion, right? That's what he's... Fine, but this is descriptive, right? Again, it's not a question of whether it should be this way. It is this way, right? Meaning very few societies have, right? I can't think of a single society in the history of the world that, right, functioned as a society with everybody in society believing that there were no consequences to their actions, right or wrong, in this world or a future world, right? There has never been such a society. Religious or secular, right? There's just no, right? In the secular society, right, consequences in this world is what keeps people, right? It keeps the law going for the average person, right? That's just true, for better or for worse. Okay, so with all of that, we're at 5 minutes left, but okay. So I'm not going to get to read the whole thing, but I do want to at least leave you with the Rosh Hashanah piece, and I'm happy to continue the conversation about Ikare Emunah with whoever wants to later. So why am I bringing this up in a context of Rosh Hashanah? So skipping down, the reason is because Rabbi Yosef Albo believes that the key to understanding the unique Shmona Esra, the unique Amidah we have at Musaf, is to understand that on Rosh Hashanah, right, the beginning of the year where we kick off the year, it's a good time to go back to basics. And therefore, he argues that the three brachot in the Amidah, each of them capture one of these three fundamentals of faith, so that we start off the year by recommitting ourselves to these ABCs of religion. Right? And therefore, he says as follows, V'ha'omorel shalosh yikar malalu shorosh v'yisod le'emunah, right, these are the three fundamentals that a person has to put effort into in order to succeed. And that's why we have the three blessings, namely, Malchiyot, Zechronot, and Shofarot, Shem Keneged, Shlosha Yikarim Halalu, because they parallel these three. Lahi'ir Lev Ha'adam, Ki Bamanari Karim Halalu, Im Sifahem, V'Sharashahem, to remind us at the beginning when we're being judged, we're kicking off the year, that what you need to be judged, right, the way you want to be judged, is a belief and a commitment to the ABCs of Judaism. And therefore he says, Ki berchat malchiyot, when we accept the reign of God, he keneged ikar mitziyut Hashem, right, that's essentially parallel to an acceptance of God's existence. V'yore al zeh nusach ha-bracha, and you can prove this from the language of the bracha itself, al kein nikavel lecha Hashem elokeinu lerot me'ira b'tiver ruzecha, that we hope to see your glory, la'avir gilulim min aretz v'alelim karot nikareitun, we'll get rid of the avodah zarah, they'll be cut off from the world, l'taken olam ha-malchut shakai, to establish the world and fix the world in the kingdom of heaven. Yakiru v'yedu kol yoshvei tevel kilecha tichra kol berech tishava kol lashon. And everyone will know, and every knee will bow. V'kablu kulam en ol malchutecha. So malchiyot, where we accept God as king, is our acceptance of ikar number one, that there is a God. Two, birchad zichronot, the bracha of remembrance, that God remembers our deeds and punishes and rewards us based on those deeds. Al hashkach, Torah al hashkacha v'aschar v'onesh. V'chein, it teaches us about the fundamental of reward and punishment. V'chein yoren nusach ha-bracha, tazocher maaseh olam ufokeid kol yitzirei kedem levanecha niglu kol ta'alumot. Right, you remember everything that's happened, etc. U'birchat shofarot, and the bracha of shofarot, hilir moz alikara shlishi, shehu Torah min ha-shamayim. Shofarot reminds us of the importance of the belief in Torah. How do we know? Al keni matchela, because it starts atanikle nigleita banan kvodecha al am kodshecha lidaberi mahem. It specifically focuses on God revealing Himself with the shofar blast when He gave the Torah. Then he notes, obviously, there are other hints, right? The shofar also hints at the Akedah. And he notes the Nishayahu, they hint at this. But his fundamental argument is, I think, what I wanted to leave you with as we go towards Rosh Hashanah, is that based on his belief in these three fundamentals, he argues that what we're really doing in Rosh Hashanah davening is we're not just talking about Malchiyot, Zichron, and Shofar, but we're actually articulating for ourselves and committing ourselves to the basic cornerstones of belief, right? That there is a God, right? Malchiyot, there is a God, He's king, and we hope that one day everyone will recognize Him as such. Zichronot, God remembers what we've done, and that's why there are consequences to what we do, schar va'onesh. And three, shofarot, that God has revealed Himself in the world most powerfully at the moment of revelation when He gave us the Torah. And I think that thinking about Rosh Hashanah is not just a day of judgment, but as a day where, as part of that judgment, we articulate for ourselves the beliefs that are the basis for everything we do, and recommitting ourselves to those beliefs and what emerges from them, I think that's a very powerful way of thinking about Rosh Hashanah. It's 1 o'clock, so I'll end there. I'm happy to stay on for a few minutes for anyone who would like to continue fighting with me about the Ikarim. Obviously, there is a lot more to do in the Ikarim, and we can argue about it for many, 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 many hours. But this is just one perspective, one analysis, which I think puts a different spin on the types of things we should be thinking about as we go into Rosh Hashanah. Okay, it is officially 1 o'clock.